Yeah, good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance meeting to order. I want to thank those of you for your presence. We had a little delay in our morning caucus between the House and the Senate. So please silence all your cell phones. The time is 9:17 on April 4th, 2023. I'm joined by the full committee, Senator Co-Chair Hoffman, Co-Chair Stedman, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Merrick, Senator Kelly. We have three bills on the agenda today for initial hearing. We will hear them in the following order. Senate Bill 22 by Senator Gray Jackson, proclaiming Juneteenth as a state holiday. SB 74, Physical Therapy Interstate Licensure Compact by Senator Wilson. Senate Bill 75, Audiologist and Speech Therapist Interstate Compact by Senator Wilson as well. If we have time, we'll bring up under bills previously heard, Senate Bill 58, which is the Medicaid Postpartum Mother's Bill. With that, Senator Greg Jackson has Senate Bill 22. Please come on up and identify yourself. Invite your staff up and identify herself as well, and go ahead with the presentation.
Senator Elvie Gray Jackson, I'm here this morning with my Chief of Staff, Bessie Odom. First, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for hearing my bill. America prides itself on being the land of the free, but it wasn't until 1865 when this statement became a reality. The Declaration states that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. But before 1865, there was a faucet of Americans still living under bondage, unable to live life as the Declaration of Independence had promised. Before 1865, black Americans were denied their rights because they were seen as property versus human beings. In 1863, President Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation that freed enslaved people in Texas and all rebellious parts of southern secessionist states of the Confederacy. However, it was only through the 13th Amendment that emancipation officially ended slavery throughout America. 2 years later, Union troops arrived in Galveston, Texas, to announce that enslaved people were free by executive decree. This marked the end of 200-plus years of enslavement of black Americans. In 2001, Representative McGuire introduced House Bill 100, which enabled the third Saturday of each June as Juneteenth Day to commemorate the abolition of slavery through the U.S. and its territories in 1865. The bill was signed into law on April 10, 2001, and it was co-sponsored by Representatives Hayes, Halcro, Murkowski, Meyer, Dyson, James, Cisna, and Kroc. The bill was cross-sponsored by Senators Davis, Ellis, Olson, Lehman, Lincoln, Elton, and Ward. And I want to thank the past bipartisan members for their efforts in recognizing and upholding the liberations of our community. Juneteenth is oftentimes seen as a black American holiday, a closed celebration for black folk only. This simply is not true. Anchorage hosts the largest Juneteenth festival in the state. It's an event that openly embraces everyone who attends regardless of their color or ethnicity. In addition to community members attending, many elected officials have attended and spoke in support of the holiday. The community celebration includes dignitaries, the mayor, the governor, local, state, and federal legislators. And I look forward to this event every year as the senator from District N. Additionally, there are other countries besides the U.S. that celebrate Juneteenth, including South Korea and Israel. As you can see, celebrating liberation reaches far beyond color and ethnicity. Senate Bill 22 will create awareness and appreciation for American history. And my hope is that we will continue to have the sometimes difficult conversations about what it means to truly be free. In this process, I want to encourage our community, the community that I love, to keep the festivities alive and continue to secure freedom for generations to come. As a side note, Juneteenth is my anniversary, and I'm going to be so honored on Juneteenth to celebrate living in this beautiful state for 41 years. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If any questions by members of this committee on this bill? If not, Ms. Odom, are you ready to go through a sectional analysis?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
For the record, Bessie Odom, staff to Senator Gray Jackson. Section 1 of the bill amends AS 4412010A, the statute regarding legal holidays. Specifically, it requires that June 19th, known as Juneteenth Day, be considered a legal holiday. Moving on to Section 2, it amends AS 4412020, the statute regarding holidays that fall on a Sunday, with conforming language that reflects Section 1 of this bill. Lastly, in Section 3, there's a repeal for AS 4412090. And this is in regards to the holiday being recognized as an observance versus a legal holiday. Thank you.
Do you have any questions from the committee on the sectional analysis? Okay. We'll go ahead and take invited testimony. We have Mike Patterson, Party for the Social Liberation, on the phone from Anchorage.
Hi, can you hear me?
You're on.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you. Thank you to the chair and the committee members and to Senator Gray Jackson for having invited me for testimony today. My name is Michael, for the record, my name is Michael Patterson. I'm with the Party for Socialism and Liberation Anchorage, and I'm calling in support of Senate Bill 22 because I am African American. I'm actually one of the organizers for the local Juneteenth celebration here in Anchorage, and I gotta say that Juneteenth is probably my favorite day of the year. It's the day that I have the most fun, and it's also just, it's one of the few days that I actually get to celebrate my community. I'm also a disabled Iraq war veteran, and I would also echo the sentiment that Juneteenth is about liberty and justice, and it was something that was really deprived to our people for centuries, and I also think it's a great example of how far the United States has come in terms of the promises that were made to everybody, the promises that were denied to us, and how far we have to go. And the fact that Juneteenth is really just a celebration of liberty and justice, I think is really just, that's universal to everybody. It's not a closed holiday. It's not like if you go to the Park Strip in Anchorage and you're not black, you're not going to get chased out and you're not welcome. Everyone is welcome. It's a celebration of emancipation and liberty. That's something that we want to share with everybody. And I also think, too, given Alaska's history of being colonized and Alaska's history of disenfranchising Alaska Natives and other people of color, that it's definitely any holiday that is going to promote liberty and justice and freedom is a holiday that we should definitely celebrate. I know on the federal level, it's already a holiday. Here in the municipality, we just made it a holiday by replacing Seward's Day. And, you know, and I think it has kind of come up in conversation that, you know, we might have to replace a holiday. And I would say that replacing Seward's Day with Juneteenth, I think it's actually pretty appropriate because if you know anything about Seward's Day or about William Seward, is that he was Secretary of State under Lincoln, and he was actually pivotal in stopping the United Kingdom and France from recognizing the Confederate States of America. And I would say that his greatest political achievement was that he helped preserve the Union, and which led to the abolition of slavery. And also, if anyone's, I just want to read from the Treaty of Session of 1867, Article 3, which reads that the inhabitants of the ceded territory, according to their choice, reserving their natural allegiance, may return to Russia within 3 years, but if they should prefer to remain in the ceded territory, they, with the exception of the uncivilized native tribes, shall be admitted to the enjoyment of all rights, advantages, and immunities of citizens of the United States, and shall be maintained and protected in the free enjoyment of the liberty, property, and religion. The uncivilized tribes will be subject to such laws and regulations as the United States may from time to time adopt in regard to Aboriginal tribes of that country. So I just want to end with saying that if you ask Alaskans, would we rather celebrate a holiday that celebrates freedom and justice and equality for everybody, or would you rather celebrate a holiday that disenfranchises tens of thousands of indigenous peoples of Alaska? I don't really think there's an argument there. And so, you know, just to close, that we really support SB 22. Juneteenth should be a state holiday. And that, you know, if we have to make a decision to cut a holiday, then we should cut Seward Day, because I think in an indirect way, if you want to honor Seward, then you should honor Juneteenth, because that's something that his greatest political achievement is, that he preserved the Union, and which led to the abolition of slavery. And I just really want to thank the committee for their time, and that's the end of my testimony. Thank you.
Mr. Patterson, thank you very much for coming out this morning and testifying. I thought that the great thing that William Seward did was he bought Alaska, and they obviously did something else as my signing off on Juneteenth back then. But thank you for your testimony this morning. Do we have any questions for Mr. Patterson by members of the committee? If not, we'll go on to Dr. Ian Hartman, from the Alaska Black Caucus, who's on the phone from Anchorage. Mr. Hartman, are you on, sir?
Indeed, I am.
Please identify yourself for the record, who you're associated with, and go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, this is Ian Hartman calling on behalf of Allies for Change, and I do appreciate the opportunity to speak to you all. Good morning, Senators. I do want to express my strong support for Senate Bill 22 to make Juneteenth an official state holiday. Juneteenth commemorates the day that enslaved people in Galveston, Texas, learned that they were free more than 2 months after the Civil War's conclusion, as Senator Abigail Jackson eloquently stated earlier. As professor of history at the University of Alaska, I believe passionately in the need for Alaskans to learn and understand our history. I believe that this bill does even more than recognize the history of black freedom in the American South at the end of the Civil War. Indeed, passage of this bill provides an opportunity for Alaskans to reflect on and learn about the contributions that African Americans have made to Alaska and ponder the deeper meanings of freedom and liberty for all. As a white Alaskan who teaches U.S. and Alaska history, and author of the book Black Lives in Alaska, History of African Americans in the Far Northwest, I've long found it unfortunate that many of our students are simply unaware of what caused the nation's civil war and the legacy of that momentous conflict. It shaped our nation and state in profound ways. In fact, formerly enslaved people arrived in Alaska as whalers, stampeders, service members, and entrepreneurs. Black men had served on whaling ships across Alaska's waters, and some had settled along Alaska's western coast. Black men and women participated in the gold rush. Buffalo soldiers provided law enforcement in Skagway as it transitioned from a frontier settlement to a stable community at the turn of the 20th century. Black soldiers built key sections of the Alaska Highway during the Second World War, and they were instrumental in the liberation of the Aleutians from Japanese occupation. In our modern era, black Alaskan leaders have emerged in education, business, the military, and politics, some of whom, of course, serve in the legislature today. While only 4% of the population, black Alaskans have had an outsized role in the state we know and love today. Of course, this history reverberates in our present day, and the effects of historic discrimination continue to shape the lived experiences of too many Alaskans. For this reason, I'd like to close my testimony by voicing my full support for and recognizing the positive impact of the Alaska Equity Center, led by Alaska Black Caucus CEO Celeste Garage Groden. The Equity Center will address health and educational disparities affecting black Alaskans. The Equity Center is on the front lines of ensuring that our community provides access and opportunities to historically marginalized Alaskans. Understanding our history requires that we grapple with the causes and legacies of the Civil War. The freedom of 4 million people of African descent was most certainly among the most important events in American history. Full stop. Recognizing Juneteenth as an official state holiday will open a space to learn more about this history and reckon with the legacies of our shared past. And at this time, we must support those in our communities who work diligently to address discrimination and racism through positive action and change. Thank you all, Senators. I appreciate your support and for your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hartman, for coming out this morning. Do you have any questions for Mr. Hartman for Dr. Hartman by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we have Anna Boson, who is Allies for the Alaska Black Caucus on the fly-in. Ms. Boson, are you on, ma'am?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, please identify yourself for the record, who you're allied with, and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, esteemed senators. My name is Anna Boson, and I'm a proud member of the Alaska Black Caucus Allies for Change. I'm calling from Anchorage, Alaska today. I am honored to testify in strong support of Senate Bill 22, authored by Senator L.D. Gray Jackson, to make Juneteenth a state holiday in Alaska. I moved to Alaska in 2007 and first learned about Juneteenth by chance when I happened upon a beautiful festival in downtown Anchorage in June 2010. I was captivated by the joyous celebrations of Black Americans commemorating the end of slavery in the United States. The music and dancing across the park strip were captivating. The sight of children performing routines while families watched with pride amongst friends and neighbors was so inspiring. Culture and collective joy was on full display for all of Anchorage to experience. I recall exploring the various vendors and exhibitors, including meeting a Buffalo Soldier veteran and author. As a white American in my 30s, I had never heard of Juneteenth before that summer afternoon, which I find extremely sad and frustrating considering how much history is touted in national celebrations. I acknowledge that I must take ownership as an adult to research and improve my awareness of America's history as my commitment to society and to make my fellow Americans do better for those who were so egregiously harmed and held back since centuries of slavery through Jim Crow era and present day. Making Juneteenth a state holiday in Alaska would be a meaningful way to demonstrate our commitment to acknowledging the past and working towards a more just and equitable future. As a white ally, I understand that I cannot fully comprehend the struggles that Black Americans faced throughout history. However, I recognize the significance of Juneteenth in commemorating the end of slavery in the United States, and it's important as a reminder of and an educational opportunity to inform Alaskans of the ongoing fight for equality and equity for all. By testifying as an Alaska Black Caucus Allies for Change to support Senate Bill 22, I am taking a small step towards creating a society that recognizes and addresses the impacts of systemic racism and oppression. It is vital that we acknowledge our history and work towards a more equitable and just society for all Alaskans. In conclusion, I urge all Alaskans, regardless of race, to join me in supporting Senate Bill 22 and making Juneteenth an official state holiday. Let us take this opportunity to honor the struggles of Black Americans and commit to creating a brighter future for all Alaskans alongside them. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning and testifying. Next we have Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, Ms. Smith, are you on, ma'am?
I'm here.
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear. Please go ahead with your testimony after you identify yourself.
I'm here. Okay. My name is Jasmine Smith, and I am a community activist and business owner, and I am one of the coordinators for Juneteenth Anchorage and the president of Juneteenth Anchorage nonprofit. And I'm here because I really do want to piggyback off the comments from the previous speakers and give my support for SB 22 and really stress that, again, Juneteenth is not limited to an African-American holiday, although that has been a big center of it historically. Like we said before, African-American history is a part of American history, and it's not something that is limited to the lower 48. We have an extensive history here in Alaska. We have a lot of people here in Alaska who have come from all over the country, whether they were moved here as an adult or as a child, or they're a second, first, or third generation Alaskan. I also want to stress to people that we have a deep history of Juneteenth here as well, like Senator L.D. Gray said earlier. We've been celebrating Juneteenth here since the early 80s. It is a massive undertaking and a huge celebration of freedom, and there are a lot of communities around the world and other cultures who know what it feels like to celebrate the freedom of your people. And that's a little bit different and goes deeper than just 4th of July because, you know, many Americans still weren't free with 4th of July. And I want to offer to everyone that this year, especially moving forward, we're going to keep celebrating Juneteenth. And it is now a municipality holiday, a federal holiday, and it would be amazing for it to become a state holiday. A lot of work goes into Juneteenth. It is a celebration of freedom, but it's also about educating on our history, our culture, our people, And a lot of organizations and businesses, both Black and allies, work together to put that event on and make it happen every year. And so I'm here to just put my support in and saying, yes, we do need to support SB 22. And if you have not had the pleasure of attending a Juneteenth celebration to understand why that day is truly important and needed, we encourage you to come out and celebrate with us this year. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning, Ms. Smith. We're going to continue on with public testimony. Next is up is Aaron Jackson Hill. Ms. Jackson Hill, are you on, ma'am?
Greetings. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead and identify yourself for the record and speak and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Aaron Jackson Hill, and I represent Stand Up Alaska and Alaskans Take a Stand. I want to extend a special thanks to Senator L.V. Gray Jackson for proposing this bill. As a Black woman and a Juneteenth volunteer, I am submitting testimony in support of designating Juneteenth as an official holiday for Alaska. This day commemorates the emancipation of African-American slaves and celebrates their journey to freedom. It's also a time for Black folks and indigenous people alike to celebrate our shared history, resilience, and achievement throughout the generations. Juneteenth has been celebrated in Alaska for over three decades now on June 19th each year with events and gatherings held across the state, making it rooted deeply in our culture. Making it an official holiday would recognize this significant part of our local history, honor all of those who fought for freedom during slavery, and bring greater awareness to the issues related to racial equality that we're still working towards today. Creating a new state holiday around the significant day will increase public awareness and understanding of the importance of Juneteenth in our state's history and culture. This will create greater opportunities for education, dialogue, and a reflection on the progress we're making as a community toward realizing racial equality. Please consider this request to designate Juneteenth as an official holiday for our state. Your action would take us one step closer to recognizing the hard-fought journey of African Americans to freedom while continuing the crucial conversations about racial justice in our society today. By celebrating Juneteenth in Alaska each year, we have already taken steps toward acknowledging the achievements of Black and Indigenous people who fought against slavery and oppression. Making it an official state holiday is both appropriate and necessary, allowing us all to recognize this significant day. A lot of fear comes from ignorance of the unknown. We want Juneteenth to serve as not just a celebration, but a time for learning, conversation, and reflection that fosters an understanding of our shared history, as well as acknowledging the pain caused by America's original sin. By recognizing Juneteenth, Alaska can become an example of how we combat racism through education, activism, and community. In conclusion, I strongly urge the Alaska Senate Finance Committee to recognize and support this meaningful day by designating Juneteenth as an official state holiday. Doing so would be an important step towards further strengthening our state's commitment to justice and racial equality. Thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next is Rosalind Grady Wick. Ms. Wick, are you on, ma'am?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you very well, and so can the rest of the committee. So please identify yourself for the record and go ahead and who you're affiliated with and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Rosalind Grady White. Thank you for allowing me to speak this morning. I am a mother of five beautiful Black children, a special education educator for ASD for all children, the president of Alaska Coalition of BIPOC Educators. I am also a member of the NAACP and a longtime resident born and raised in Anchorage and a member of the Juneteenth Anchorage Committee, who all her life got to enjoy being at the Park Strip with her family, being one of those food vendors. Shout out to Rosso's Skyline Restaurant, now called Rosso's Food for the Soul. The Alaskan Coalition of BIPOC Educators is calling in support of SB 22, a bill presented by Senator L.V. Gray Jackson, that would make Juneteenth a legal holiday in the state of Alaska. ACBE is an organization that supports the education and the BIPOC community, especially disenfranchised neighborhoods. And we encourage, again, the state of Alaska to get on board with the municipality of Anchorage and be a part of forward progress. Let's continue to be a culturally diverse state and be an example for other states and represent the holidays of the people who make up this community. The name Juneteenth references the day of the holiday, combining the words June and 19th. On June 19, 1865, when Major General Gordon Granger led the Union soldiers to Galveston, Texas, to announce the end of the war and the freedom of all enslaved people. Since then, Juneteenth has symbolized the end of slavery in the United States and is observed by Black communities throughout the country as a celebration of emancipation of our freedom and the freedom of Black people. So far, only about 18 states have made Juneteenth a state-paid holiday, which meaning state government offices are closed and state workers have a paid day off. Again, Juneteenth is the oldest nationally celebrated commemoration of the ending of slavery in the United States. This holiday is considered the longest-running African-American holiday and has been called America's second Independence Day. This is already a federal holiday, but again, let's make this a state holiday so that we can be inclusive and create opportunities to celebrate the cultures that are the fabric of our city, state, and country. We desire to leave a heritage rich with diversity, and celebrating these days as paid holidays recognized by the state of Alaska would be in a step of that direction. Thank you. I'm a teacher, so I've got to go, but we do support, all my members do support this, and I ask you again to support Senator L.V. Gray Jackson's bill, SB 22. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning, Ms. Grady Wake. Next up we have is Ty Tigner. Mr. Tigner, are you on?
Good morning, Senate Finance Committee, and thank you, Senator Jackson, for including me in this process. I am calling from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I am the executive director at Presbyterian Hospitality House, and we serve children all across the state, and I'm going to keep my remarks pretty limited. I am the first African-American executive director at Presbyterian Hospitality House, and my agency has been serving children since 1957. I've been with the company for 35 years. And my thoughts are that it's important to have this as a state holiday so that we can teach our young people, our children, the significance of it and some of the history that goes along with it. I've also heard a lot of testimonials today that speaks to Anchorage and the Park Strip. And although I've been there, it is a wonderful celebration. I live in Wasilla and I work in Fairbanks, and it's celebrated statewide. So I would strongly encourage the committee to look at this bill that's been brought forward and to support it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming out this morning, Mr. Tigner. Next up we have is Sophia Metters. Ms. Metters, are you on, ma'am?
Yes, I'm here.
Please identify yourself for the record, who you're affiliated with, and go ahead with your testimony.
Yes, hi. My name is Sophia Metters. I am the president of the GAP program and vice president of Juneteenth Anchorage, and I'm calling in support of SB 22. I came to Alaska in 1985 from Arkansas, and it was a big culture shock because I come from a place where I'm in school and in a town where there's only people like me. And so the change of the culture coming to Alaska in 85, where there was not a lot of people like me, Juneteenth made me feel very good inside, and it helped me to get past the culture shock that I was going through once I arrived here. I have a program where I support African-American and Indigenous youth, and it's very important that they are able to understand the culture and understand the education that's behind Juneteenth. It's important for our independence, and it promotes our acceptance of the culture, and a culture that goes unnoticed and is constantly downplayed. As a child and now Juneteenth has always been important to me, as I get to be proud of myself and get to enjoy people like me and teach my kids to be proud of themselves. Juneteenth supports education to the youth and those who are unaware of the history. And I believe that is very important to recognize. And so I am honored to be here, and I'm hoping that everyone else is on the committee and everyone else is here to support and legalize this as a official holiday of Juneteenth. I appreciate you guys' time, and I hope you guys have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning, Ms. Meadows. Does anybody on the committee have a question for Ms. Meadows for her testimony this morning? If not, we're going to close public testimony. We have on the line from Legislative Legal, Margaret Burrood. For any legal questions we have for her. Ms. Burrood, thank you very much for coming out this morning. I don't see any questions from the committee for you. So we'll go on to the fiscal note. There are two fiscal notes, one from the OMB, one from the Department of Administration. We have Kate Sheehan, the Director on the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. You come on up to the table and identify yourself for the record, who you're affiliated with, and go ahead and go through the fiscal notes.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kate Sheehan. I'm Director of the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations. Both fiscal notes are going to show as indeterminate. If this bill becomes a paid state holiday, there's approximately $4.3 million. But why it's indeterminate is depending on the collective bargaining agreement. If you have, like, for instance, a 24-hour institution, you may have to either, they will take a holiday later in a 30-day period, or they might get paid time and a half, or they may take it later that week. And so it's indeterminate that there may be some overtime costs associated with it. So the way we figured out approximately $4.3 million is if everybody took a paid state holiday is what it would cost. That being said, because of collective bargaining agreements, there could be a higher cost, but it would depend solely on letters of agreement or collective bargaining agreements.
Any questions by members of the committee for Ms. Sheehan?
I do.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you. Ms. Sheehan, trying to get the clarification. Is the 4.3 just an average work day? Because there's conversation on the difference between we would pay that anyway, so are we valuing that as a work loss evaluation? And the difference between that or the, as you mentioned, the time and a half that someone may work, the double time, or, you know, switching that holiday for some other time. So is that additional cost to the state? We're just trying to get the best estimate of that, of this cost.
Ms. Sheehan?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, this is what we looked at what we paid for a state holiday right now. So it's, I don't want to define it as time loss, because we have 11 paid holidays already. So we just looked at what we already paid on a state holiday. Again, it's indeterminate because in some positions there's no time loss. But yes, there would be a day that employees were not working, and that's what we calculated, that we were paying them for an additional day of not working.
Mr. Wilson?
Yes, so, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm just making sure this is the total cost of a state holiday of what we currently pay, not a portion of all employees sort of as a normal work day.
Ms. Sheehan?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's correct.
All right. Thank you.
Senator Jesse, you
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure I'm tracking your answer to Senator Wilson's question. So $4.3 million is the amount of holiday pay coded going out on checks. Is there an offsetting reduction in the amount of general pay going out?
Ms. Sheehan?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, potentially. So not every employee will take the holiday. I would have to bargain. So this is statutory, but it's also in collective bargaining. So I would have to bargain this additional holiday, and then it would grant them an extra holiday. But again, depending on the collective bargaining agreement, some take the holidays, some don't. But it would be an additional benefit and pay for them. I'm not sure if I tracked your question correctly, Senator.
Bob, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the reasons it is indeterminate. I'm trying to sort of zero in on the net. If a GGU state employee gets this day and shifts, the holiday pay goes up, but they get fewer hours under their usual pay code, that sort of sounds like net zero. I understand the overtime and the 24-hour institutions are a separate consideration. So that's what I'm trying to grapple with.
Through the chair, Senator Kill, yes. If they were to take a day later, they would get paid for it. It would still be considered holiday pay.
Any other questions for Ms. Sheehan by members of the committee? If not, I guess the bottom line is that there is no additional cost from what I'm reading in the fiscal note for this holiday being taken. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, there would be an additional cost of a minimum of $4.3 million.
And how many people are affected by, how many employees are affected at these 24-hour facilities that correctional officers, the troopers, the workers of the Pioneers Home and things like that?
Mr. Chair, we have approximately 14,000 employees, and again, I would have to bargain this, and there are contractual provisions where when there is a law passed that I do have to bargain it, so I would bargain it, and then I would have to pass personnel regulations. I would say approximately in our 24-hour institutions is less than 2,000 people that we would be concerned about overtime. It would be our Pioneer Homes, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute, correctional officers. You would have troopers that can't take the day off. You have some laborers, trades, and crafts who work on, the haul road and things like that. But we already care for that either in the collective bargaining agreements or through letters of agreement on how we pay out those holidays.
Okay. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Thank you for being here today. Are there any state holidays that people do not get a day off of work, and is it possible to have a state holiday where people still have to go to work?
Ms. Sheehan.
Through the Chair, Senator Merrick, no. If there is, well, again, depending on agreement, there are some agreements with the unions where you do not get the holiday and you just get paid an extra time and a half. And you don't take the holiday ever.
Thank you.
Any other? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know, was that in response in terms of, I guess, Senator Merrick's question, there are state holidays that are unpaid holidays, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, yes, we don't. The only state holidays that we pay are what we've bargained or what are in the personnel rules.
All right. Thank you.
So, Ms. Sheehan, as you look at the cost of $4 million, if it was to add a holiday where you didn't have the offset, what would that cost approximately? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chair, I don't know.
Okay. Any further questions for members of the committee for Ms. Sheehan? If not, I want to thank you very much for coming out this morning.
Thank you.
Any closing comments by the bill sponsor? I'm sorry, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have some comments that I would like to throw out there on the record. We've heard from a lot of folks and even conversation in this building about this bill possibly becoming switching to Seward's Day. And I just want to make some comments on that. I feel that I don't think the municipality of Anchorage did that. And Seward's Day did a lot more than just, Seward did a lot more than just purchase Alaska. He was a staunch advocate for all men that were created equal. He risked everything on that belief, including harboring fugitive slaves, Mr. Chair. He was a person who helped sign the proclamation and strengthen the Emancipation Proclamation by changing two key components to make sure that that will last way beyond Lincoln's administration. So I'm deeply opposed to that because otherwise that diminishes the value of both how meaningless holidays are, and that demeans what this holiday and Sewers Day is. You know, then what's next? Are we going to be going down there, down the street, to tear down the court, you know, the statue of Sewer down by the courtroom? I think that's, you know, it's what we're heading to. Other comments that were made, you know, just letting folks know that I have colleagues, I have peers, I have acquaintances, I have friends and family, and in this role I have a constituent, but I don't have allies. So I don't know what an ally is to the black community. To me, it's never a term that I grew up with, never a term that I heard. And so I don't have allies. I don't know what that is. And the other term that I find highly offensive is BIPOC. It's a very offensive term. And if we really, really want to do more for the African-American community and minorities, the best bill that we have now floating through this body is Senate Bill 58, the Medicaid bill, will save more minority lives and do more for minorities. Just that's just the data shows that than this bill. I'm just want to throw that out there. This isn't a surprise to my colleagues. This is not a surprise to Senator Gray Jackson. We've spoken about this piece of legislation. I'm not urging or encouraging people to support this bill or oppose this piece of legislation. I'm just throwing that out there, that this is just a very difficult conversation for a lot of people to have in an honest way, and I'm just throwing that out there of where I am with this, and I just feel that we should take some more time to evaluate the cost of this piece of legislation. It's already a holiday on the state books. Governor passed this back a while ago. I don't have the AS statute of when this became a holiday, and I just feel that we don't need to make it a state-paid holiday.
Senator Wilson, thank you very much for your comments. I agree that Mr. Seward was a person with some deep convictions. Whether they were popular or not at the time wasn't the issue. He thought what was right was right, what was not right was not right. And so having him, you know, almost paying with his life after he got attacked and almost killed, or the intent was to kill him, he certainly bore the scars till he was laid in the grave. And so I have the utmost respect for William Seward. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think someone once said there is no such thing as a mere symbol. And these holidays are about symbolic significance. I certainly think that we as a state could do more to honor the purposes of Juneteenth Day and the history of Juneteenth Day than we do today. And I won't engage on all the issues that the colleague sitting next to me raised, but one where we really, really do disagree is that shifting a holiday to the ones that aren't paid isn't about diminishing or insulting, or I forget the exact verb. We do not diminish or insult prayer by the Alaska Day of Prayer not being a paid holiday. We do not diminish or insult Pearl Harbor veterans and those lost at Pearl Harbor by Pearl Harbor Remembrance Day not being a state holiday. This is an interesting bill, and I'm generally supportive, but I think maybe we could turn the temperature down just a little bit on what it means to be in that category of not being a paid state holiday.
Any other comments by members of the committee on this Senate bill? If not, Senator Gray Jackson, do you have any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did have a brief presentation, but for the sake of time, maybe we can just not do the presentation. But, Mr. Chairman, and to the committee, I have to make this comment. With all due respect to Senator Wilson, I'm offended by his comment regarding tearing down Seward's statue. I had to say that for the record, because that is not what this is about at all. I have high regard and high respect for Seward and Seward's day. And the conversation only happened because of the fiscal note and the cost involved. But for me, Mr. Chairman, You cannot put a price on celebrating freedom. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly. If you would consider entertaining the presentation, I think we have it's such a significant issue that we'd be willing to go ahead and watch the presentation if you want to go ahead with that.
Mr. Chairman, that would be great. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
For the record, this is Bessie Odom, staff to Senator Gray Jackson. So what is Juneteenth? Juneteenth is known as Freedom Day, Jubilee Day, Emancipation Day, or Liberation Day. The word Juneteenth resulted from the words June and 19th being combined together in early speech. In 1863, Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation that freed enslaved people in Texas and all rebellious parts of southern secessionist states of the Confederacy. However, it was only through the 13th Amendment that emancipation ended slavery throughout America. 2 years later, Union troops arrived in Galveston, Texas, to announce that enslaved people were free by executive decree. This marked the end of 200-plus years of enslavement of black Americans. Enslaved people in Texas found out they were free nearly 3 years after the fact of the 13th Amendment being signed. In Galveston, Texas, the newly freed individuals held large public celebrations and so laid the base for future Juneteenth activities across America. Going into recognition of the day that spans across the U.S. and abroad, Texas was the first state to pass legislation that would require Juneteenth be observed as a state holiday in 1980. This was followed by Florida in 1991, Oklahoma in 1994, Minnesota in 1996, Delaware in 2000, and semi-recently Idaho in 2001. Various companies across the U.S. also observe this holiday in various fashions. This includes Tesla, Nike, Target, NFL, and Lyft. It's also worth mentioning for the record that this list is not inclusive of all the companies that observe the holiday in one way or another. Juneteenth celebrations are also held beyond the borders of America and countries such as South Korea, Israel, France, Guam, Honduras, Japan, Taiwan, and Trinidad and Tobago. On June 11, 2021, President Biden signed a bill making Juneteenth a federal holiday. It is now one of 11 official federal holidays, or 12 for federal workers in the District of Columbia and surrounding areas during presidential inauguration years, meaning that federal workers get a paid day off. Bringing it back home to Alaska, most recently the Anchorage Assembly voted unanimously to make Juneteenth a municipal holiday. So what does it mean for Juneteenth to become a state holiday? In some states, people employed by the state may have a day off of work. Stores and other organizations and businesses are likely to be open as usual, but some may be closed or have restricted opening hours in some areas. Many public transit services operate on their usual schedules, but there may be some minor changes. Thank you.
Is that the end of the presentation, Senator Gray Jackson?
Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the presentation. It certainly is something that the only question I have is, on slide 3, where you've got the recognition of the day across the state, you noted that one of the companies that also recognized it was Lyft. Does that mean I can't get a taxi on those days? I'm probably going to pay a higher price for that. Well, thank you very much for your presentation this morning. We're going to set this bill aside. It certainly is one of those things that is a significant holiday. I just want to remind or in the history of American Alaska Natives that we have Elizabeth Paradovich Day, and although it's not a paid holiday, it's certainly something that's significant in our lives and not nearly as monumental as Juneteenth Day when the soldiers drove into Galveston and set that 200 years of slavery to say. With that, thank you very much for coming out this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Odom, thank you.
Members.
Next bill up we have is Senate Bill 74. Senator Wilson, Physical Therapy Interstate Licensure Compact. You can stay at your seat or you can go to the head of the table and go ahead with your presentation, Senator Wilson. And identify yourself for the record as well as your staff person there and present us the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Senator David Wilson, Senator for District N, and with me is
Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson.
If I could just have a brief at ease here.
Brief at ease.
Again, for the record, Senator Dave Wilson, before doing an introduction today, I'm going to quickly turn this over to Ms. Martin, who will go over sort of the structure as these are sort of very similar bills, and so we'll do a quick overview of sort of both bills together, and she'll just lay that out for committee members.
Ms. Martin, identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your presentation.
Yep. For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So as Senator Wilson noted, these two bills are very similar structurally. They both allow us to enter a respective interstate licensure compact, and so we're going to be presenting them kind of jointly to allow questions on the same topic to be answered at the same time as opposed to jumping back and forth and answering the same questions and going over the same information. Distributed to your offices were binders on the legislation. In the first section of the binder is information that is relevant to both pieces of legislation, documents that are cover both pieces of legislation. In the second section is documents for Senate Bill 74, and in the third section is documents specifically for Senate Bill 75. For the structure of the presentation today, Senator Wilson is going to do an introduction. It's going to be relevant to both pieces of legislation, again, because they're both very structurally similar. I will do a sectional analysis for Senate Bill 74, if the committee would like, and then for Senate Bill 75. And then if we could, we can move into invited testimony. We have invited testifiers that are going to be able to speak to both bills and answer questions about both pieces of legislation. And so, again, answering those questions at the same time. We also have a couple testifiers that are going to speak individually to their respective bills. Again, the people here to speak for the audiologist and speech-language pathologist, we could try to ask some questions about physical therapy, but I don't think they're going to know the answer and vice versa. So with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Senator Wilson for an introduction of the pieces of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Again, for the record, this is Senator David Wilson. Before the committee is Senate Bill 74 and Senate Bill 75. These are interstate compact contracts. As interstate compact is a contract between two or more states. It carries the force of statutory law and allows states to perform certain actions to observe certain standards and cooperation in a certain policy area. By promoting these type of cooperation action among states, interstate licensure compacts increases an actual quality of care by decreasing some of those license burdens to licensing and will maintain rigorous licensing standards and state sovereignty. These compacts create a reciprocal professional licensing practices between states while ensuring the higher quality and, again, safeguarding that state sovereignty. Both compacts, the physical therapy compact and the audiology speech licensure compact, uses a privilege to practice model where a person obtains a licensure in their home state or their home state of residence, and licensure can be used in their home state license to apply for a privilege to compact, a privilege to practice in another member state. When a person is using this, the remote state, they are subject to the remote laws, including the scope of practice, must pay those fees set by the remote state, which is different than other compacts you've heard about coming through in the last year. And for examples of this, for these fees set in tab 4 of your binder in section 74 shows how this works in terms of some of the fee structures. A remote state can take action also to revoke a privilege to practice in that state. The speech physical therapy became an official in 2017 and has been adopted by 34 states, why the audiology speech licensure compact became official in 2019 and has been adopted by 23 states. As Ms. Martin noted, we brought these binders, and I'll just go through these binders. I know Senator Merrick and Senator Bishop have already heard this presentation in another committee, a first referral, and so they were deja vu. And the first tab is sort of what's a compact, and going through in the first section, you'll find a lot of documents from our councils of state government, and many of you guys know that is one of our trade associations that provide wonderful technical assistance to many members in different focus areas and helping all 50 states and some territories. The Department of Defense has partnered with CSG, the Council of State Governments, through a cooperative agreement to provide support and counsel of development of these compacts and many other compacts as well. Many of the states through the National Center of Interstate Compacts, which is housed within the Council of State Governments, they help states collaborate on these complex policy issues. They strengthen economies, protect public health, and is the only national provider of technical assistance on interstate compacts. That's why we're using them today to provide some expert testimony as well. Again, under your binder in tab 2, we start talking a little bit more about the multi-state problem and solving interstate compacts, how they're formed, the purpose, legality. Tab 3 is the interstate licensure compacts, sort of how they the differences between the universal laws, geographically displaying licensure compacts throughout each member state. And tab 5, just highlighting another example of the driver of different types of compacts. States involved in many compacts, for example, our driver licenses, interstate compacts that allow you to drive in all 50 states and territories. We have one driver, one license, one road. We provide, one other one that has been talked upon is ERIC. ERIC's one of those voting registry state compacts that the state's involved in that helps with voter security, and that's been a issue that we're talking about now in this building as well. And again, in tab 4, 70, and then Senate Bill 74 is tab 4 has all those supporting documents. Again, the fees by each individual state, which is different than other compacts. We can set our fee for compact members, which is different than other state compacts that we've talked upon, that have been talked upon in this building. And SB 75 has, again, the similar information in the supporting documents in tab 4 of the brief and the overview of these issues. And with that, the letter of supports are also in the packets as well, supported by many agencies, school districts for both compacts, AARP, for example, and I will let Ms. Martin, if you will, Mr. Chair, go over the sectionals, just SB 74 and SB 75.
Any questions by members of the committee for the bill sponsor? Senator Wilson, I do have a question. I've got a couple of questions. One is that if a person has a license in another state, it's recognized by a second state, and the person, whoever the licensee is, comes into question, and they suspend that license, does that mean they don't have a license in the other state as well?
For the record, this is Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. A big piece of these compacts is information sharing. And so it depends on, there's two states a person could be practicing in. They could be practicing in their home state, and that's where they have their home state license, and in a remote state, and that's where they have this privilege to practice. If their home state is the only one that can take action against their home state license, and if their home state license is encumbered, they're not eligible for privileges to practices in other states, and that's communicated to the other states. And then for the privilege to practice, if an action is taken against their privilege to practice, their privileges to practice in other states are revoked, but the home state is the only one that takes action against the home state license. These remote states report this information on this negative action back to the home state, and the home state can take action based on that.
So, Ms. Martin, if I'm hearing you correctly, the remote state can go ahead and have an action against the licensee, but that doesn't necessarily suspend or even for sure doesn't revoke the license from the home state. Is that correct?
That is correct, but they report, for the record, Jasmine Martin, that is correct, but they report that information to the home state for the home state to take action.
Okay. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess a follow-up along those lines. If Alaska gets a request for a privilege to practice, and they see the home state license is not encumbered, but they see privileges have been stopped or revoked in some other states. That home state still didn't take action. Can we refuse a privilege to practice based on that?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, if we could ask that question to some of our invited testifiers, they're actually the ones that administer the compacts. I think I have an answer for you, but I don't want to be incorrect.
You're willing to wait on that, Senator Peel?
Yeah.
Okay. The other question I have is, as you see the things going on down the way, why don't we just go to federal licensing of these licensees instead of having every state go through the heartburn and the mental gymnastics of trying to have this stuff done? What's the advantage of keeping it like it is as opposed to having a federal license situation?
Mr. Chair, this is Senator David Wilson. State sovereignty. I mean, that's one of the things that we can do. We're still nimble and we're still flexible in terms of our regulation requirements. And that's the last thing a lot of members and a lot of constituents would like is sort of that federal arm into our state licensing. And, you know, I will let the department speak for the Department of Boards Commission's license, and I think the director's here, and she might add additional comments to that. But I think the last thing they want to be do is to be told how the slide says on how they would like to have licensing requirements to maintain and to abide by. I think that's something that we've heard in this building and other committees and dealing with other state licensing is that the state of Alaska would like to maintain a lot of autonomy and control over its licensees and not to give that control up to other entities because Alaskans know how to take care of Alaskans best.
Any other questions by members of the committee, both the bill sponsor and his chief of staff? If not, we'll have Sylvan Robb come on up. Ms. Robb, will you please come up and either answer the question or go ahead with your presentation and answer the question, as well as the question that Senator Keel had as well. Take a brief at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Ms. Robb, do you have any comments you want to make as well as you remember the questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, the Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing at the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development. Mr. Chair, I believe your question was, why don't we just move toward federal licensing?
That was one of the questions. There was a question by Senator Keel as well.
To your question about federal licensing, Mr. Chair, so within the department, we license a great number of professions, about 125. 21 of those professional areas are governed by boards. And as Senator Wilson alluded to, that does give us local control over the scope of practice, what the requirements are when discipline is imposed on those licensees. And so it allows us to craft the practice for Alaska to meet our local standards and just to align with local standards.
I totally agree with that because we've got different in the scope of the practice of medicine, certainly practicing medicine in Shattuck is a lot different than practicing medicine in downtown Juneau or Anchorage. So I totally agree with we want to maintain our state sovereignty as well as continue on to provide the service. You had a question, Senator Keel?
Through the chair to Senator Keel, if I may, Mr. Chair, Ms. Martin indicated that there are folks who work at the compact and eat, sleep, and breathe this every day, and so I would prefer to defer to them to answer Senator Keel's question, if I may.
We can hold off on that question until a little later than when we do have that. Anybody in particular, Ms. Martin?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, either Jeff Rosa, he's with the Physical Therapy Compact, or Nahali Kalfas with the American Speech Language Hearing Association Compact.
Okay, thank you. At this time, we're going to go through the sectional analysis. Ms. Martin, go ahead.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So this will be the sectional analysis on Senate Bill 74. Section 1 adds implementation of the Interstate Physical Therapy Licensure Compact to the list of duties of the State Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board.
Section 2 and 3 adds a fingerprint requirement for physical therapists and physical therapy assistants and occupational therapists and occupational therapy assistants. Just on a side note, the occupational therapist piece is not a requirement of the physical therapist compact, but adding this keeps the professional language in line with each other and is useful if the occupational therapists ever move forward with pursuing a compact for their profession. Section 4 adds fees for compacts. Compact privileges, the list of fees the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development may charge. Section 5 adds a privileged practice to the list of exceptions under which someone not licensed in the state may practice physical therapy. Section 6 is a very long section. It is the compact language section and is the bulk of the bill. It's a section containing the uniform language adopted by all states entering into the compact. Page 6, line 1 through 4. This is just an introduction to the compact language. Compact Section 1 under Section 6 defines the purpose of the Interstate Physical Therapy Licensure Compact. Compact Section 2 is the definition section. Compact Section 3 explains the requirements the state must meet to participate in the agreement. Compact Section 4 explains the requirements for obtaining a privileged practice. Compact Section 5 relates to active duty military personnel. These compacts are, the development of them is partially sponsored by the Department of Defense. They're very interested in these compacts. You'll see later we have a testifier from the Department of Defense. And so just defining where their home state is and different things like that is a little bit different for military families. Obviously, there's a section specifically for them in both pieces of the compact legislation. Compact Section 6 is the adverse action section. This section explains how the compact home in remote states may conduct and report adverse actions, as well as the consequences for a physical therapist or physical therapist assistant who receives adverse actions. Compact Section 7 is the establishment of a physical therapy compact commission. This section lays out parameters for the physical therapy compact commission. Compact Section 8 is identical to compact Section 9 of the audiologist and speech language pathologist compact, Senate Bill 75. This section denotes the requirements for sharing licensee information for all compact states. A compact state shall submit a uniform data set to the coordinated database on all physical therapy compact physical therapists and physical therapist assistants to whom the compact is applicable as required by the rules of the commission. This database will allow for the expedited sharing of adverse actions against compact physical therapists and physical therapy assistants. The coordinated database information will be expunged by the law of the reporting compact state. Compact Section 9 describes the process for creating rules that would govern compact operations once the compact is accepted by first 10 states. Both compacts have been accepted by 10 states. Compact Section 10 details the oversight and enforcement of the compact by member states. Compact Section 11 is the date of implementation of the Interstate Commission for Physical Therapy Practice and Associated Rules, Withdrawal, and Amendments. This is the same as Section 12 of the Audiologist and Speech Language Pathologist Compact. Compact Section 12 is the same as Section 13 of the Audiologist and Speech Language Pathologist Compact. This section states that the compact shall be liberally construed to effectuate the purposes thereof. And this is the end of the compact language. The next section is Section 7, which adds a section to our Code of Criminal Procedures, adding physical therapists, physical therapist assistants, occupational therapists, and occupational therapy assistants to the list of fingerprints that may be submitted to the FBI for a national criminal history check. Section 8 amends uncodified law to set transition language for physical therapist occupational therapist assistants who are currently licensed and have not been fingerprinted. And Section 9 sets a delayed effective date. That concludes this sectional, Chair. I have a couple notes on the language of the bill, if I'd be allowed to go through them quickly.
Please.
So there's two pieces to the bill that could use some adjustment at the will of the committee. One of them has to do with the background checks. Right now, we gathered some more information on how those background checks would work. If you look at the fiscal note, it includes a bit of a UGF draw and some more information on it. If we amend this to bring it in line with the compact and not require everyone go through the background check, but just new licensees, then we can fix this and we're still in line with the compact. The second piece of language that was inadvertently left out was to allow the department to immediately begin adopting regulations. They can adopt regulations once the bill is effective, but it does have a delayed effective date, and they would like to be able to start working on that as soon as the bill passes.
And Mr. Chair, this is Senator David Wilson. We do have those amendments drawn up for the committee to consider that would help, again, lessen that physical impact. And I believe when we cover the notes, Ms. Sullivan Robb can also speak to that as well to try to have a minimal impact on the UGF draw as possible.
And that mainly has to do with background checks, Senator Wilson?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
That's the case then. Have there ever been anything in somebody's background checks that has denied or delayed licensure in one state or another? How significant is it? Is my real question.
Mr. Chair, again, Senator DeWilson, that's a huge piece of this. I mean, obviously, I mean, for any background checks, is you're trying to provide safety and security for these people, for the folks that are under the influences of these practitioners. And so that's a huge piece of public policy that we want to make sure that we're providing. And I can't speak to the numbers, but I'm sure that we have, in my realm of behavioral health, we have stopped providers from practicing because something has been found in their background checks due to some either barricade laws, which probably do need a little bit of reforming in the state. But there have been issues that have stopped licensees that I've known in different practices in that profession. And I'll let Ms. Sullivan Robb speak to those that may have be speech pathologists or audiologists that may have come through the department. But I do know background checks have stopped certain providers from practicing in the medical realm and in the behavioral health profession as well.
I can understand the gravity when you're dealing with behavioral health and even medical practice for that matter on a background check, but for somebody that's an audiologist or physical therapist, have there been any significant findings in a background check that have proven that they would not be licensure, or would there be a delay in the license that's going on there?
For the record, this is Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. Currently, we do not require background checks for audiologists and speech-language pathologists and physical therapists. This background check is so that we can share the information with states that do require that. It wouldn't implement a requirement for passage for our licensure, and I'll let Director Robb.
I understand that the state may not have it, but have you, in your research, has any other state had issues where they had something significant turn up on a background check?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. Not off the top of my head, but we do have the compact professionals online if they'd like to speak to some of the licenses that have been turned down.
Ms. Robb, would you like to answer the question?
For the record, Sylvan Robb. Mr. Chair, Ms. Martin is correct. We do not currently require criminal history background checks for the professions that would be governed by these two bills. So this would be a new requirement moving forward for new licensees.
Yeah. But my question has to do is, has there ever been a time where somebody, either a physical therapist or an audiologist, found something significant in the background that has denied or delayed licensure? And if you don't have the answer to the question, that's fine. I just don't know that. I guess I've never heard of it. While in other realms under occupational licensing that you do provide licenses for, like behavioral health, there would be something a lot more significant and a lot more dire consequences if it wasn't caught. And so I totally agree with that. So,
Mr. Chair. So I am not familiar if other states have found things in criminal background checks that have prevented or delayed applicants from obtaining a license. I would be surprised if they have not. We do have a number of professions that we license that do require criminal history background checks. And for those, if we do see something on those background checks, that can either lead to a delay as we investigate further what that incident was and if we feel comfortable proceeding or the board feels comfortable proceeding with issuing that individual a license. And there have been a few cases where an individual has been prohibited from obtaining a license because of information that was revealed through a criminal background check.
But not necessarily in a physical therapist or audiologist, is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair, because we do not currently obtain criminal background checks.
Thank you very much for at least trying to answer the question anyway. With that, we're going to go on to invited testimony.
Mr. Chair, just...
Senator Wilson, go ahead.
Sorry about that, Mr. Chair. I just do want to add one more point to that. I think the idea for some of the background checks in other states is because audiologists do work with vulnerable populations. Normally they're school-aged children and sometimes the elderly for physical therapy as well. So some of those vulnerable populations just for those protections. But before we go on to my testimony, Mr. Chair, can we just would like to recommend if we could do the sectional for Senate Bill 75 as well, so we can get that on the record.
And you will the committee to try and go through 75, or do you just want to do 74 first?
You're the chairman.
If that's easier for you, Senator Wilson, we'll go ahead and listen to 75.
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. We'll do 75 while 74 is still fresh in your mind. I will note again where the languages are identical through the two pieces, and then you'll also notice some of the language is very similar. They're drafted obviously at different times, so things are a little bit different between the two, but there are sections that are very similar as well. So sectional analysis for Senate Bill 75. Section 1 and 2, again, relate to the criminal background check for audiologists and then for speech-language pathologists. Section 3 allows the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to charge fees for a compact privilege. Section 4 allows a person granted a compact privilege to practice as an audiologist or speech-language pathologist in Alaska. Section 5 is that compact language again. Again, this is the bulk of the legislation. It is the uniform language adopted by all states entering into the compact. Compact Section 1 is the purpose section. Compact Section 2 is a definition section. Compact Section 3 explains what requirements must be met by the state to join the compact. Compact Section 4 explains the licensing requirements the state must meet to participate in the agreement. Compact Section 5 states that by accepting the compact, the jurisdiction will allow for the practice of telehealth, which Alaska does. Compact Section 6 is this active duty military personnel and their spouses section, similar to Section 6 of the Physical Therapy Compact. Compact Section 7 is this section explains how the compact, home, and remote states will conduct and report adverse actions, as well as the consequences for an audiologist or speech-language pathologist who receives adverse actions. Compact Section 8 establishes the ruling commission of the compact. The compact is not a waiver of the state's sovereign immunity. Compact Section 9 is exactly the same as Compact Section 8 of the Physical Therapy Compact. It is the data system section. Compact Section 10 is the rulemaking section. This section describes the process for creating rules that will govern the compact operations once the compact is accepted by the first 10 states, which it has been, has been accepted by 23 states. Compact Section 11 details the oversight and enforcement of the compact by member states. Compact Section 12 is the same as Section 11 of the Physical Therapy Compact. This is the date of implementation of the Interstate Commission for Audiology and Speech-Language Pathology Practice and Associated Rules, Withdrawal, and Amendment. Compact Section 13 is the same as Section 12 of the Physical Therapy Compact. This is the construction severability section. Compact Section 14 states that the compact will be binding among the member states. And this concludes the compact language section. And so we're back to Section 6, which amends the Code of Criminal Procedures to add audiologists and speech-language pathologists to the list of fingerprints that may be submitted to the FBI for a national criminal history check. Section 7 sets transition languages. Section 8 sets an effective date of July 1st, 2024. And I have the same notes on the language that I did on the first bill regarding adjusting that background check language and allowing for the department to immediately adopt regulations related to this legislation. That concludes my sectional, Chair.
Any questions by a member of the committee on the sectional analysis for Ms. Martin? Senator Keel.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Both of these bills have some liability shield language that is kind of striking. I think we were on SB 74, I think it's on page 17. And I think it says that if someone who works for the commission is here meeting with Ms. Robb and falls asleep behind the wheel and kills somebody, they can't be sued because they were doing it in the course of their duties. What, Why do we need that instead of having the commission buy insurance?
Senator Wilson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Senator Keel, what can you reference that page? And
sure, Mr. Chair, on SB 74, I think it's at page 17. Lines 16 through 26. And if a commission employee is in the course of their work, so they've met with our CBPL director and they're leaving the state office building and they're staring at their cell phone and they bump a wheelchair user down the stairs, it's not willful or intentional. That's ordinary negligence. Somebody got hurt, but they can't be sued for that?
For the record, this is Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. Chair Olson, would it be all right to let our invited testifiers speak to that as well?
For sure. And which one in particular?
With Senate Bill 74 is going to be Jeff Rosa, but Nahali Kalfas would probably have some information to add to this conversation as well.
Okay. Without any further questions, we'll go ahead and go on into invited testimony. Mr. Rosa, are you on, sir?
Hi, can you hear me, members of the committee?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear. Please identify yourself and who you're affiliated with and go ahead with your presentation. And then you can go, if you have, can remember, go ahead and go to the answer the question next.
Okay. For the record, my name is Jeff Rosa, and I am representing the Physical Therapy Compact Commission. Members of the Senate Finance Committee, thank you for considering Senate Bill 74. I'll be happy to answer any questions that the committee may have about the Physical Therapy Compact Commission and its administration at the end of my testimony. The Compact Commission is an independent governmental entity that currently consists of 33 states and the District of Columbia, and each of the states previously enacted the same legislation that you are considering today. And the purpose of the compact is to facilitate the interstate practice of physical therapy with the goal of improving public access to physical therapy services while enhancing public protection. The compact is an alternate pathway for physical therapy providers who meet the eligibility requirements to obtain the privilege to practice in other states within a matter of minutes instead of days, weeks, or months. As Senator Wilson stated in his testimony, instead of the multi-state license model in which an individual licensed in one compact state can legally practice in any other compact state with no notification requirements to the remote state, under the PT compact, when a licensee wants to work in another active compact state, the individual must purchase a compact privilege for that specific state, and in addition to the fee that is charged by the compact commission, each state is authorized to charge an additional state fee for the purchase of a compact privilege. And ultimately, the compact privilege becomes the legal authorization for that individual to practice in the remote state. The compact improves public protections by requiring full participation by member states in the central license and disciplinary data system, including regular reporting of disciplinary actions to the commission, which are automatically shared with the other member states. So in essence, if a home state takes action against the home state license, that individual is prevented from purchasing a compact privilege for a period of at least 2 years. And once the license is restored back to good standing, the compact privilege would be automatically issued if they were purchasing the privilege in a remote state. So I believe that hopefully addresses the question that Senator Keel had asked earlier. The PT Compact is widely supported by physical therapists and physical therapist assistants, including those who live and practice in Alaska. I also want to make a comment on the fiscal note, although I believe that previous testimony is going to address this issue, but in our experience from the other 28 member states that are currently active in the Compact, we have not seen any state where there was a need for the staffing level that are identified in the fiscal note for the bill. Specifically, the two long-term non-permanent administrative assistant two positions, really all of the work associated with processing the compact privileges, and then anyone that wants to renew a compact privilege, that is all done directly through the compact commission. So it's not the actual remote state that is processing the initial application or the request for renewals. And in addition, the requirement for the criminal background check would only apply for individuals that are applying for an initial license in Alaska. It is not a requirement that an Alaska PT or PTA has to complete the criminal background check every time they are renewing their license in Alaska. So it really is just a requirement that has to be completed when the individual is initially applying for a PT or PTA license in Alaska. To address the criminal background check issue, physical therapists do actually also work with vulnerable populations, that there are many PTs in the school settings or they're working with children with significant developmental delays or working with elderly that do. We want to make sure that those people also are not potentially have something in their background that could potentially harm those consumers. Even things like a home health physical therapist or a home health PTA, you know, who may have been convicted for forging checks, having that individual have the ability to go into somebody's home unsupervised and potentially having access to a checkbook could actually cause considerable harm for that individual. And prior to my role with the Compact Commission, I was the executive director of the Physical Therapy Board in Ohio, and we did have a criminal background check requirement in place long before the Compact was around. And there are cases where we had applicants for licensure that did have criminal history that ultimately led the board to either not issue a license or issue a license with restrictions based upon the criminal history that the individual had identified. And in many cases, although many boards have a question on licensure applications asking about criminal history, we often found that people that had significant criminal history in their past were not truthful on their licensure applications. And without having the additional information from the criminal history check, we would not have known when the person said, no, I've never been convicted of a crime, that actually was incorrect and that they actually had lied on their licensure application. So that is some of the basis for the requirement for the criminal background check, at least as it pertains for the physical therapy compact. With that, I appreciate your hearing the bill, and I'm here to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Mr. Rosa, we still have a question by Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Rosa, my question didn't go to when the home state takes action against a license. That pretty much matches what we have now. If a Kentucky licensee gets yanked by Kentucky and they come to Alaska, CBPL is going to say, wait a minute, you had a problem. The question is about what happens if the home state does not act. And you know, we'll just go with Kentucky because they border eight other states. If you've got a home state licensee of Kentucky and Indiana and Tennessee both have revoked the practice privilege, but Kentucky hasn't encumbered the license, when Alaska gets a request for a practice privilege, can we say nope? Or is that based only on the license being encumbered in the home state?
Mr. Rosa, do you understand the question?
I do, and through the chair, Senator Keel, I would say the answer to that is it's not necessarily a straightforward answer, unfortunately. So if the person has a license in good standing, it's been past the 2 years, past any action was taken either against a license or against the compact privilege, they would automatically be able to get the privilege in Alaska. Now, one of the benefits of the compact, though, is the information sharing that is required under the compact. So not just the sharing of actual disciplinary actions that boards have taken, but the compact also requires member states to notify other states if they are actively investigating an individual with the thought that if the violation that is being investigated is a significant violation, that the other state has the ability to take parallel action against the compact privilege, even for a violation that may not have occurred in that remote state. So that allows for, you know, if the person is also licensed or has a compact privilege in Alaska and the home state doesn't take action, Alaska could take action against the compact privilege. But once any of the state has taken action against a privilege, and then the person would lose all of their privileges for a two-year period, if the home state chose not to take action against the home state license, after that two-year period, that person would be eligible for the compact privilege in Alaska, and the privilege would automatically be issued.
Honorable Senator Keel?
No, Mr. Chairman, concerning.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Rosa. And we'll go to our next invited testimony. That's Alec Kay from the Alaska Physical Therapy Association in Anchorage.
You know, I mean, it comes and goes, and I cannot figure out. Like, I walked that.
She's his own, right? Ms. Kay, are you on, ma'am?
I have no idea what my walking would make it hurt. And it just comes and goes.
We can skip her.
Okay. We'll go ahead and go on to our next person. That's Eric Cordero, the Alaska Policy Forum. That's under public testimony. Yeah. We'll open public testimony then and have Alec Cordero. Are you on, sir? Is he on?
Hello, good afternoon, good morning, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Cordero. I'm with Alaska Policy Forum. Alaska Policy Forum is a 501c3 nonprofit that is a nonpartisan state-based think tank and does not receive any public funds. We encourage the adoption of policies that allow for professional and occupational licensure compacting between states. This is vital to ensuring economic growth and stability and create more opportunities for workers in various fields. Currently, many states have unique requirements for obtaining professional licenses, which can be costly and time-consuming for workers seeking to move across state lines. This can create a significant barrier to entry for highly skilled professionals who would otherwise contribute to local economies. However, by adopting licensure compacts, states can allow for greater mobility for licensed professionals and create more job opportunities. These benefit workers and the local economy, allowing for a more competitive job market and more efficient use of resources. Furthermore, allowing for licensure compacts can help with the problem of Alaska's out-migration. Many highly skilled professionals leave their state searching for better job opportunities, which can hurt the state's economy. By creating more job opportunities and reducing barriers to entry, states can retain more of their talented workforce, and continue to grow. In conclusion, consider adopting policies that allow for professional and occupational licensure compacting between states. Creating more job opportunities and promoting economic growth and stability makes sense. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Mr. Cordero, thanks for coming out this morning. Next, we have Kelly Chick from Ketchikan.
Hi, this is Kelly Chick. I'm from Ketchikan, Alaska. I am a physical therapist, PT practice owner, and I've lived in Ketchikan since 1995. I've been in private practice there since 2003. And I actually came as a locum contractor with, let me go see Alaska, you know, and then put it on my bucket list and then go back someplace else. Which is honestly how most of healthcare industry comes to Alaska. I just was one of the ones that stayed. And so since the 90s, I have a long history of just kind of understanding the industry around hiring, getting PTs, you know, having them have an experience in Alaska and ideally stay like I did. We have always had a heavy reliance on contract companies to help us attracting PTs to Alaska. For better or worse, there's in that industry, there's a lot more come and go, which means ultimately we deal with licensing on a much more regular basis, I think, than some of the other professions that exist, not in healthcare, but because healthcare deals with it. You could ask the Division of Occupational Licensing just how loaded they are with that. And that's part of my reason for supporting the PT Compact. As a business owner, we've had, especially since COVID, with changes in staffing and whatnot with licensing, it's always been challenging, but never as much as recently in the recent years, to get licenses processed in time for a therapist to start. And just to give you an example, I hadn't given this testimony when I, at the last committee hearing, but you know, look at economics. I had three separate therapists incoming, and we lost a month of production, 4 weeks of production, because in total, between those three different, you know, therapy starts, they each had to wait between a week to 2 weeks to get their license processed. And, you know, that's the cost to the business. And if I can't get staff and qualified staff, then my business is suffering. You know, to be able to provide services for a population that really needs it. And so it hasn't come up yet, at least in this, that I've listened to in this, testimony or process so far. But, you know, licensing issues are a big piece of the reason for wanting to have a PT compact. You know, we're always challenged to find a qualified pool of PTs, but there's something about the bureaucratic process. If we can make it a little bit smoother, I think Alaska stands probably even more than most other states to be able to attract more qualified therapists, physical therapists, to come and want to put their name in the hat. I'm very selective about who I choose, but the bigger the pool, the better. You know, then you don't have to deal with questions of integrity, you know, and practice violations and whatnot when you get to be more selective about the people that you're picking. It's an interesting conversation to have around background checks. Every contract company that I've ever worked with already does a background check on anybody that they're any recruiting, you know, that they're sending to me with a resume. And we do our own background checks in-house as well for anybody that would be coming on permanently. But that's what you're looking at. You're looking at a significant flow of therapists, you know, coming and going from Alaska on a regular basis. The other piece that I would just add that's kind of unique to me that I think at least talks to the benefit of a PT compact has to do with continuing education that we don't have in Alaska for advanced degrees within the profession. And just speaking for me personally, I mean, a PT compact license would be an incredible asset for me to go get additional training in an EMG and nerve conduction electrodiagnostic residency that I'm actually in. And it's just been a headache to try to get the mentoring, the process done, because the flow isn't, you know, really high volume and a small outing in Ketchikan. So I'm going to have to go travel to get my experience. But my goal is to bring that back to Alaska in order to provide that service, you know, throughout the rest of my career for Southeast and Ketchikan. And, gosh, we haven't had it in Ketchikan since the 90s or before. Like, I don't think we've ever had it as a regular service to offer. So, you know, for people that are dedicated to Alaska to be able to have that ability to, you know, get additional education and utilize that resources is significant for me personally. And I just think that overall, you know, the process of PT Compact opens the door for people that would entertain Alaska qualified candidates to provide physical therapy. And then, you know, a lot of times we convert them at least for a season, you know, or longer than, you know, what they typically have is 13 week assignments, and we keep them longer, you know, but there is a tremendous flow in terms of licensing, and the PT compact would make a huge game change there. And honestly, it would improve the flow for the licensing processors. And I'm sure that would save the state money. So that's all I've got. If anybody has any questions.
Ms. Chick, thank you very much for coming out this morning. It certainly is a balancing act to be in business as well as being a licensed provider. With that, I want to thank you for coming out this morning. We're bumping up against the 11 o'clock for the session, but if Ms. Robb could come on up and just cover the fiscal note briefly so we could have a complete presentation on 74, and we'll hold the rest of 75 till next time. Is that okay with you, Senator Wilson? Okay. Ms. Robb, can you cover the fiscal note at this time?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb. So the fiscal note for SB 74, right now you'll see that the costs don't start to be incurred until fiscal year 25. That's because of the way the transition language is written and when the current licensees' licenses will expire. The costs that are reflected on the fiscal note, based on the changes that the sponsor is considering related to requiring criminal history background checks for current licensees, will have a large impact on the fiscal note. So if that requirement for those background checks were to be removed, the cost for the bill would be substantially decreased. So in FY25, the cost would be $117.5, and that would be all from Fund 1156, which is Receipt Supported Services. And then in subsequent years, the cost would decrease to $105,000, again, entirely Receipt Supported Services. So the fiscal note is higher as it stands now, written to the bill in its current form. Mm-hmm. But with the anticipated changes, we would see a reduction in the fiscal note.
Any questions for Ms. Robb by members of the committee? If not, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside. We'll cover the rest of Senate Bill 75, which deals with the audiologists at our next meeting. With that, we will go ahead and stand adjourned for the Senate Finance Committee at 11:02.